Hey, hey, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Angle on Producers, the Labor of Love podcast, where we take you behind the scenes and into the shoes of producers across all corners of the entertainment industry. Together, we help demystify the age-old question, what exactly does a producer do and how do they do what they do? I am your host and fellow producer, Carolina Gropa. However you found the show, thank you so much for tuning in and doing this live thing with me. If you don't already, please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Apple, Spotify, even YouTube if you fancy. We also just launched a Patreon. I hope you consider supporting the show. We have big dreams, but they require more time, more people, more risk. In other words, more money. And a dollar can mean different things to different people, we know, especially right now, but it all helps. So if you're in a position to give, please head on over to patreon.com/angleonproducers and give what you can to help the show grow and evolve. On today's episode, I have the privilege of speaking to Dr. Rachel Ramist. Rachel is an episodic television director and a college professor who's recently directed episodes of the family fantasy show The Spiderwick Chronicles, the musical Up Here, and the soapy drama Sex Life. She has also directed beloved episodes of one of my favorite shows, The Sex Lives of College Girls on HBO, Wu-Tang and American Saga, Fantasy Island, and Diary of a Future President, which may sound familiar to you because we had Alana Pena, the show creator, showrunner, on the show not that long ago. Rachel's journey is a masterclass in rolling with the punches, and her story and resilience are inspiring, to say the least. She's one of those people I could sit and talk to for hours and never run out of things to say, as you'll gather from this episode. So I hope you enjoy and get as much out of our conversation as I did. So without further ado, here's Rachel. Well, I am delighted to have you on and to finally meet you. I feel like your name is one of those that's been circling me for a while. And I was just telling you before we started recording, I hit up a lovely Latina that I'm working with who's been on the podcast, Gabby Lugo. And I was like, oh my God, have you heard of Rachel? And she's like, yeah, she's like my mentor. And I just love the unity, you know, every time, like, even for me, I still think like, maybe they should know each other. And I just love when, like, yeah, it's already been happening. I'm just like behind the ball, you know, I'm late to the party.
Yes, Gabby Lugo is amazing.
She's
and
the best.
Thanks for having me. I mean, I love these kinds of conversations and I love the podcast. One of my personal missions is to make the industry more transparent and more accessible. And, you know, previous to the current times, I feel like there was enough pie for everyone. Right now, I think there's only big pieces of pie for certain folks, but that's okay because we can't control the industry. What we can do is be really good at what we do, be prepared, show up, and really support each other. So that's part of my mission. So yes, I work with Gabby and lots of other Latinas and other directors in a lot of different ways.
I love it. Very mission aligned. And since you started on that note, I am curious, do you think that seems like right now we're all getting, you know, crumbs of the crust thrown our way, to keep with that metaphor? Do you think that it's going to bounce back and there'll be full pies to go around for all of us?
I think things are changing. And I think there's always a need for good stories and good storytellers. So I can't control how many shows or what pilots I book or don't book. All I can do is show up and be really good and prepared. And if I'm the right director, if I'm the right creative, then it's going to work. I think we're going through such a shift right now that you're seeing big movie stars get TV shows. So some of us cannot compete with that. And that caliber of talent is going to request directors that they've worked with.
Right.
So I'm, you know, the meetings that I'm having, they're like, great, but this, the number one is only working with people who they've worked with because they have this long career. I can't control that. So I have work on the horizon. Do I have all the work that I used to have? Not yet. Do I think more is coming? Yes. Can I predict when? No. So the good thing is I have a PhD to fall back on. I teach, I mentor, I started an online film school. I think now more than ever, it's clear we cannot control what the industry looks like and what those hiring pipelines are doing or not doing. What we can control is our own creativity and the ways in which we can find support So whether you're a teacher, you do service work, or you have some other something, I have a filmmaker I'm mentoring who sells clothes online. Like, whatever the thing is to do your thing, now is that time to exercise that. And, you know, the rest I cannot predict, but they're going to need content. They want to charge us for every app and streaming and thing. They've got to keep making things if we're going to keep paying for all those things. Because now my bill is higher than it was with cable TV because I have so many services. So the ebb and flow.
Ebb and flow. Well, you touched on something that I'm curious how long it took you or has taken you to arrive at this very healthy, seemingly healthy mental health disconnect from, you know, sense of worth or value based on what the industry is doing outside of our control. And I think you said, you know, you can't control what the industry is doing. You can kind of just look at yourself and have other things that fill your well. But I think sometimes, I speak for myself, when I was a younger person in this industry, that was something I really struggled with. It took me a long time to figure that out. And it caused me a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression, a lot of that stuff. So I'm curious, like, how long it's taken you to reach a place where you feel like you can confidently say that and mean it.
I mean, this business is a roller coaster and I hate roller coasters. I always have. I don't like that butterflies in your stomach and the big, big highs and the big lows. But the last, I'd say, year and a half has really drilled home what's important to me, who is important to me, and what can you do in those moments of these very low lows and these dips? And one of the things that I am lucky to have is this very strong sisterhood of other DGA women directors. And we text, we check in, we Zoom, we have Zoom parties. And, you know, I'm like, how many shows do you have? What's going on? Do you this? Oh no, everyone has a show but me. What is happening? And I think it's easy to spin because this roller coaster and because it doesn't matter. Our own view of our value is only one part of it, right? Because people's careers ebb and flow even before this moment. Some people have a lot of work. People have intermittent work. Some people are struggling for work. Again, I cannot control that part. But what I do have is my health and my mental health and great support team. And so it's not that I don't panic or get upset or get really stressed. It's what do I do in those moments of panic where I think maybe our younger selves spin and we get caught in these stories that we tell ourselves. All I can control is how I react to whatever thing happens to me. And so, you know, I broke my ankle right before the strike. I slipped on ice and fell. I had to navigate a lot of things in terms of my own disabilities and my strength. And the safety of sets, because they're not always the most safe for different kinds of needs and accessibility. I'm working on that part. But I lost a lot of income. And then that can spin you out. Like, I'm a grown-up with kids and real bills. And breaking my ankle forced me to literally sit down and spend a lot of time with my thoughts and sort of how do you navigate? And I dropped out of a couple shows because I was injured. And then when I was ready, the world said, nope, on the bench, strike. And I believe in, you know, fair labor wages, you know, safety on sets, all the things. But the financial burden was tough and that can wear on your mental health.
Yeah.
And so figuring out what are the things that you need to be well, right? What is the income you need? What is the sort of time and space do you need? I actually moved out of the city center and now I'm like suburban mom, but it actually worked for me because I want home to feel like a beautiful place, a peaceful place, a quiet place that when I walk out of my office door, I am, you know, a mom and a friend and a neighbor, and I'm not in the constant grind. So it's sort of, I can control my thoughts, I can control my actions, and I can manage the stress, control the industry we can't do. So I think that's something I have learned is sort of, how do you ride out that roller coaster when you hate the dips? Like the high highs are incredible,
of course,
but then after the big highs, you often hit the biggest lows, and that's the sort of cycle.
Yeah, no, thank you for that free therapy session. I'm certainly in like a lot of ups and downs and lulls just in this season of my life and, you know, what I'm trying to manifest and what I'm working towards. Like you said, the things that I'm, the energy that I'm putting forward, but there's only so much I can do because I can't control the tempo of the industry, especially when I'm on a personal timeline for a variety of reasons. And so it's a good reminder, because it's like, I've been here for 17 years. I know this, like I should know better, but I feel like that's part of why I love doing the show, because every time I have impressive ladies like yourself on, you know, we just remind each other of this, and it helps us all collectively keep going just a little longer through our lulls. Or if you're listening to this where you're on a high and you're sending positive energy to the people that are feeling low, you know, like it's so important, and it really takes that collective and community. Like you said, I think that's one of the hardest things to find sometimes in LA and whatever niche you fit in. And that can really wear on people, because this business can grind you down. And if you are consumed by it, like I said, I am guilty of this. I say this not out of judgment, but as a person who has literally lived these struggles and is trying to find my own groove, you know, after so long, still trying to find my own sense of what does balance look like to me now. And it changes all the time as life progresses and priorities shift. Yeah. So I think this is great. So thank you so much. I will be sending you some money after this for the free therapy.
Now, everyone needs a squad. So, you know, we've heard about the squad in American politics of, you know, women who stand up for what they believe in, even when the internet criticizes or does whatever to those women. And in the DGA, in the Women's Steering Committee, we started a women's mentorship program for several women. I didn't start it. I just am part of the leader team now. And, you know, the principle of the squad is, so it's mid-level, mid-career women directors. And normally programs are like just starting or, you know, entry level. We wanted to do mid-level, mid-career, because what happens to women directors, women filmmakers, right? We reach a certain point, and then what does that level up look like? How could it be? What could it be? What do you need? And if we knew how to do that, we more of us would do that, but many just get stuck. And so in forming the squad, it's, you know, you apply and you give a list of mentors and why, like what in their career path, what in their work inspires you, sort of. So you're envisioning, you know, maybe someone a few steps ahead of you, and what have they done, and, you know, finding the sort of right mentorship. And that's all important and incredible. You need to see someone who's done something before you often to like forge that path. But even more than that, the squad is this sisterhood of, it's the squad community of these filmmakers together. So that's turned into text chains and WhatsApps and parties in people's backyards and checking in and support and sending flowers on the day when, you know, mergers happen and executives and your pilot gets shelved and you're like, this is the best thing that ever happened to me. And now this is the like biggest career hurt. This really hurts me. And then a squad sister sends a card, an email or something, and is like, you know, you're great. The industry sucks, written more eloquently, but you know, those kinds of things. It's like, it's not just like who's above you or who's below you. It's like, who's walking side by side with you, helping you, lifting you up, pushing you, pulling you back when you're like going too hard. I think everybody needs a squad, and it doesn't have to be an organized program, but it should be a community of like-minded creatives who understand, because you call family or your best friend from high school, who I'm still very close with.
Yeah, but it's different.
Like, you're still not working? Like, I thought TV was back. I thought the strike was over. And I'm like,
and you're like, the time it takes to just explain how this works, it's like, I just need someone to listen and be on the inside and get like the struggle. You know what I mean? And like you said, the realities of how this industry functions, because it is very unique. It takes time to figure it out. And then you do feel like, am I the ally or is it just me? Am I the only person going through this or feeling this? And similarly, I have so many groups of women that I'm a part of now, and especially hearing from women who have been here longer than me and being reminded, they're like, we lived through the strikes in 08 and we lived through so much more. And like, this business is constantly evolving and changing. It's not just unique to this moment. It may feel that way because it's, you know, coming off the heels of a pandemic, it's a lot more than any of us have ever lived through. But I think having that reminder and that mirror of like, okay, we've been here before and it comes with some pain. Certainly, it's all change does, but there's also a tremendous opportunity for growth and to evolve if you want to look at it that way, right? I think your point is really fair of like, we can only control how we react and how we're going to fill ourselves up. And I talk about this on the show a lot. It's like, how do you sustain yourself so that in the meantime of whatever timeline that is for you, you're not becoming a jaded, cynical, empty shell version of yourself, because this industry can be poison sometimes and take so much away. And frankly, they don't care. Like if they suck you dry and you leave, that's fine. There's like 10 other people waiting to take your place. It sounds really crude, but it is true. I've seen this. But you know, there are many humans that are here doing this Lord's work, and we need them all, especially if you're a woman and you're listening. We need all of us to stay the course and stay strong and fight for all the things that we're constantly fighting for. And so it's important.
Just because something has been a certain way in the industry doesn't mean that's the way it has to be. Yeah. So when directors are pitted against each other because there's only one director of an episode or a show or a film, so we're in direct competition, especially my other Latina director friends, right? We are the same people are pitching on the same Latina-led pilot. I knew my friends were pitching against me for a pilot that I got. I know I'm pitching against other friends on these feature films because like there are some folks who are just great directors and they can direct anything. So imagine other directors that we're good, we can direct anything. But there becomes this sort of burden of explain to us how you really understand this story and these characters and these things. So then a director who comes from a certain gender or identity category, we have to have lived the show, the storyline, the characters, the something. And then those of us who have similar backgrounds pitch against each other. So of course, it's going to create this sort of competitive climate. But I think, what does it take from me to be happy that my homegirl got the show or got the episode? They picked her because she's the right director, and maybe I'm not the right director. So my little practice is to like thank the universe for whatever like stress, conflict, problem, thing that is not supposed to be mine. Because when I get picked, when I get hired, it's because I'm the right director, I'm the right group. I'm big energy, big personality. And when folks hire me, they're hiring me for all of that.
Yeah.
So I think there's some reframing to do, and there's sort of work in sisterhood to support each other and sort of make a pathway. And when someone calls me to say, oh, I'm interviewing for this show that you did, like, I'm happy to share what it was like and what kinds of questions they ask. And I'm very transparent in my own process. And I've been teaching classes online, open to anyone, to share, like, what does it look like in a meeting? What are the kinds of things they ask you? What's the question behind the question? And more transparency and generosity helps all of us. And it doesn't, I saw a news article yesterday of someone alleging, you know, they stole my jobs and we know who they are. Right? Like that's the argument of diversity and inclusion is you are stealing my job. Well, it wasn't your job. We all have to compete for the job. You know, it just, and we're still these small little spaces and little
comparatively.
So, you know, I think what are the values? Can we shift what competitiveness looks like? Can we shift what resilience looks like? We shift the lonely soul, you know, creative, fighting the good fight by herself. Like, can she, you know, team up and crew up? Like,
yeah,
you're on location working on a show. It can be very isolating. So reach out to other folks in that city. Like, that's one of the things we've been doing with social media and, you know, Facebook groups and other things is like, who's in this city? Who's here? Let's have dinner. Let's hang out. So I've met many other like journey woman directors, episodic guest directors out in the world because we're in some city.
Yeah.
And so I think if we shift values, if we shift the way we engage, if we shift the things we take on, I think we can transform and really be the change in energy and culture that we want in the industry. Like, I'm not expecting the industry to change for us. I am bringing who I am and all that I am and my values into this industry that's like, wait, what? You're supposed to be battling her for this show.
Right.
No, I'm bringing my best self. I'm bringing my best ideas. Are they the right ideas? Or if not, like, I hope she gets it. And not.
And I think it's beautiful to, like, I think it's important to encourage a competitive nature because it is a competitive industry. But it's like you said, whatever flavor you bring is going to be inherently different than this other person. So, like, showing them under the hood of, like, here's how the sauce is made. It's like, you're going to make a different version of that same sauce. Like, it's just what's going to happen because you are a different person with different perspectives. You're inherently a unique individual, unless you're truly, like, you know, plagiarizing what somebody is doing. Even then, it's like, you're still going to put your own spin on it, you know? So I think that, like, the more that we use this competitive ideology that we've come up into this industry with to make ourselves better and be like, here's the deck that I made that got me this job. Is your work on par with that? Not that you need to be doing the same deck, but in terms of quality, like, this is the bar. Are you working at that level, you know, to, like, really hold yourself accountable for how competitive it really is and how good you really have to be, especially nowadays, for any of it. And so I think the more that we uplift each other in that sense, instead of being like, oh, I'm not going to tell her, like, the real, I'll be like, this is good. Good job. You know, instead of giving that real feedback that can actually make someone go from good to great and then to undeniable eventually, you know, which people love that word in this business. I think that's, like, the right move. And it takes a huge level of maturity to get to that point. But I do think we're sort of on the cusp of that. You know, I think that we did come up at a time, women before us, where there was only a place for one of us and to exist. And now there's maybe 10 of us that can exist. And eventually there'll be 100. And hopefully this kind of can go away a little bit. But I actually want to bring us back to the beginning a little bit, because, like, clearly you and I could just talk forever about this, but just a little bit of your journey, because it's fascinating. You know, you're Puerto Rican, you grew up in New York, you started in the hip hop scene, which is really fascinating. You worked in music photography, you made docs on the subject. Then you were a professor, and then you got turned into a series director because you met Ava DuVernay when she was still a publicist. Like, it's just wild. And I love the sort of trajectory of that, because I always talk about how you got to start where you are, no matter where you're headed, especially when Hollywood or filmmaking or whatever it is about storytelling feels so distant, because you just don't know how things are going to intersect. And I think the beginnings of your journey are just, like, an incredible example of that. So take us back and just talk a little bit about that whole trajectory.
Yeah, the true beginning was at Middletown High School in Middletown, New York. A teacher named Fred put a camera in my hands, and he really changed the trajectory of my life. And I think it's why I grew up to be both a teacher and a director. I learned at 16, I was very, very shy. I was short and I was small, and I spoke in a little voice, and I didn't speak aloud a lot. And I made a documentary in high school, and it put the town in a whole uproar. And people cared about what I had to say when it was through the story. And I felt really powerful with a camera in my hands. I felt really important, and, like, my ideas matter. So I went to film school, and I went to UCLA. I did an undergrad in film and television. And then I believe I was one of the first invited from undergrad into grad school into the MFA directing program, invited to apply, because they, at that time, they didn't even want their undergrads in the graduate directing program. But it was a Latino professor, AP Gonzalez, who I'm now very tight with. And he signed my DGA paper to get in. And I work with through the Latino committee at the DGA. So again, another teacher who had a big influence in my life. And he said to me and another director who grew up to be Justin Lin, he said to the two of us, I think there's something here. You all should apply and continue in grad school. He saw something in me that I had not yet seen for myself. And I applied, and I went directly from undergrad to grad school. And then I was in production crew with all men, because that's what film school looked like, and that's what the industry looked like. And in some places, still looks like that, but not the shows I work on, not the places I work. But, you know, I learned a lot about who I am. And, oh, I'm not good at hair and makeup. I want to be on the camera team. Like, I should be directing. You know, I think that's a big lesson for me all along, is, like, learning your skill set. So in high school, I learned I am technical. I am smart. I am a good communicator, even though I was very, very shy embodied. But with a camera, I became powerful. And in college, I learned, like, if I raised my voice and not shouting, but like spoke with confidence and conviction and passion, I can inspire people to move and do things. And I made, you know, made some short films that moved folks. And then folks wanted to work with me and build with me and connect with me. And I continued on to grad school. And it was rough, personal challenges. Both my parents got cancer. They were diagnosed 3 weeks apart and died 2 months apart. And I got pregnant during the middle of that process. And when I was like, I don't want kids. Like, I want to be a filmmaker. I want to be a director. You know, but life sort of hands you things, not necessarily when you want it or think you want it or don't. But, you know, my daughter was to be the first grandchild. And so I had her in grad school and I would nurse her in the middle of Pro Tools class. And I insisted on a changing table in the restroom. So even though the space wasn't conducive to me, I pushed on that space to make it more accessible for what I needed. And because I got pregnant, I pivoted from a big, expensive thesis that was going to cost a fortune to a documentary. And I shot handheld, balanced on my big pregnant belly. And I made a documentary about the community that I was in. I made the first documentary about women in hip hop. I had, through grad school, been working in music. I ran street teams for record companies. I had a partner who was a DJ and worked at a label at the time, my daughter's father. And I used to shoot EPKs and interviews and concerts. And then I got asked to shoot photographs and write articles and do videography. And so I was taking my love and passion of music and filmmaking and combining those things. And so I finished that MFA. And then a friend in the MFA program said, you should teach, because I was like post-production TA and teaching people how to edit and teaching people. I worked in the equipment room because, again, I love technical stuff. So I was like cleaning cameras and fixing things. And it was actually in the equipment room that I realized I was pregnant. I fainted, which happens to some of us. And the equipment room manager, Abdash, was like, Rachel, I have many children. You are pregnant. And I was like, no, I'm not.
Oh, no.
And I was. He was not wrong. So basically, those pivots in life and in family and in career trajectory taught me, like, just because I was thinking and planning to do this doesn't mean this pivot doesn't put me on an equally as creative, amazing path. And so I started shooting bigger and bigger concerts and doing bigger and bigger magazines. And then I was writing for Source and Herb and Vibe. And then I got a call. I was teaching at UC Irvine and I got a call like, hey, we're starting this like hip hop magazine. It's like cool urban skater. I don't know. It's called Complex. So I moved with my then 2-year-old back to New York, and we lived on 117th and First Ave, a couple blocks from the East River Housing Projects where my mother grew up in New York in Spanish Harlem. And I like helped start a magazine, and we were going to do a DVD magazine. Innovative at the times. Now sounds ridiculous. Then it pivoted from this cool magazine to a men's magazine. And I was kind of like, I'm a feminist. I don't know. Like, this is not a jam. It became sort of dream job that was combining like filming, storytelling with hip hop and urban culture and good vibes. And I was traveling and shooting like B-boys in Chile and Argentina and like having the time of my life. And then like, it was not, it was like men's magazine of the early 2000s. And I was like, so I moved back to LA. And I still worked for the clothing company Echo, which founded that magazine, but I pivoted again. And at that point, I was doing freelance stuff and shooting fashion shows and skaters wearing the clothes. And then I got an alert on my two-way pager that said, Gwen Pugh at the University of Minnesota teaches first ever class on women in hip hop. And I was like, you can do that? Like, I could do that. And I searched. This was pre-Google, so I didn't Google. I just searched. And found out about a PhD program in gender, women, and sexuality studies at Minnesota. I had never been there. I'd been to Chicago. That was like the only
closest.
New York, LA, like Chicago. And I applied and wrote my story about what was it to be the only woman on stage of very long rap concerts, to being the only woman in my film school production group, to dream job turned feminist nightmare. And then I moved to Minnesota and really invested in developing my critical lens and my academic and scholarly background and started like writing blogs and writing books. And, you know, it was interesting, but I was able to combine what I do with media with the sort of theoretical lenses. And I wrote all these grant proposals and I set up a computer lab and got all these cameras. And I had women's studies majors and African-American studies majors making documentaries and digital stories. And when I finished, they named the center in my name. So there is something called the Rachel Ramis Feminist Media Center at the University of Minnesota, 425 Ford Hall.
Amazing.
Long way said, I'm a person who's like, if I'm creative and I'm telling stories and I'm putting good into the world and I'm helping other people, I'm in my groove. I then had another, I had twins and one twin passed. So again, a big roller coaster, lots of highs, low lows. And then, you know, was married and divorced. So now I'm a single mom of two, finishing my PhD, and I went on the job market. And I wanted to be in a place where I could teach both production and directing, but also like women's studies, women of color feminisms, hip hop classes. And so where does the girl from New York who went to film school in LA, who studied in the Midwest, go? The Deep South. So I went to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And that was a brand new experience and a bit of a culture shock, but it was incredible. I met incredible people. There were so many pockets of hope. I was able to build a program where when I got there, there were 1,000 production majors and they weren't allowed to check out cameras. So, you know, figure out how that filmmaking.
Wow. Went.
And now some of my former students at Alabama direct episodic television and like are on there.
Amazing.
One is on her, you know, 18th episode in 2 years or something.
Unbelievable.
We're in writers' rooms. And I love that. So if I can direct, incredible. If I can support others, incredible. And it was through my professorial life that I reconnected with Ava, who you mentioned. And she called me and was like, girl, what are you doing in Alabama? Like, And her family was in Alabama at the time. And, you know, she came, spoke to my students, mentored the students, hired them, and then called me up and was like, girl, it's time. You do so much for other people. What about you?
Mm.
And I said, well, okay. I haven't directed television. I was like training in film school for features, but TV sounds fun. And I'm tenured. I was the second Latina tenured teaching production in the country. I was like, I have a job. If I'm not good at this, I have a job to go home to. But it turned out I was pretty good at it. I love the like energy, creativity, the collaboration. And Queen Sugar was just a dream show. It was the way I had wished sets looked like when I was in film school, where yeah. You see everybody. It looks like the world. There's all kinds of races, ethnicities, genders, you know, folks from all different regions of the country. And it was incredible and fun. And that was really the thing. Once I directed an episode and then executives at OWN were like, so who are your reps? I said, I don't have reps. I have class in Tuscaloosa. Like, I'm about to drive back to Alabama. And they're like, yeah, we think you need a rep. So then they sent me out and I got management and my manager is incredible. And he sent me out and meetings turned into meetings. And I took a leave of absence and moved back to LA and then did another show on OWN. And then a general meeting turned into my third show. And then being on set on that show, the executive was like, you need to be on my other show too. And that turned into the other episode and the next and the next and the next. And until I slipped on ice and broke my ankle, I was back to back to back.
How many years is that from your first Queen Sugar
ice? It was 2018. I shot it in May 2018. Then I moved back fall of 2018. I did Greenleaf top of 2019. And then I was working until the pandemic in 2020. And then I was one of the first directors to go back, not in scripted TV, but in an industrial. I was shooting before there was COVID set safety protocol or testing. But that experience on that project helped me get right back into episodic when things relaunched. And that's when I did Diary of a Future President, another Latina-led show. I know.
Ilana's been on the show. Yep.
And, you know, that was my first half hour because I had done hour long, mostly soapy dramas. And my manager said, you know, what's the coming out of the pandemic? Like, what's the show you really wish you could direct? And I said, it's going to sound crazy because if you look at the kinds of shows I've done, but what really is speaking to me. My son came to me and said, "Mommy, you have to see this show. It's about the single mom. She's got two kids. It's this family story." And then when my daughter came home, then he was like, "Sister, you have to watch this show." So then I had watched every episode that was streaming multiple times because he was so excited about this like single mom and her kids and all the things. And so I wrote my manager an email about why I love this show and why I would want to direct it. And even though it's a
what show is it?
That was Diary of a Future President.
Oh, it was Diary. Okay.
Yeah. And so then he forwarded the email to Alana, who I had met through a DGA Zoom for the Latino committee. And next thing you know, it's like, you know, here's an episode. And so that was the first show that I did coming back out of COVID. And then it was back to back to back.
I mean, people need probably a pause and a drink of their coffee, a bathroom break. That is just like so incredible. I think sometimes we get really stuck on what we think the path is going to look like, right? And how it's going to unfold, especially as women, when we are navigating into stepping into motherhood and all this stuff. And it can be really scary to feel like, especially I think if you're in LA, as you know, now know, but when you're not here, you're untethered, you're sort of like, I don't know, maybe, maybe not. But here, it's like everywhere you go, it's around you, right? And you are like, just it's in your face and it's hard to really disconnect. And so, you know, it's hard to not be stuck in that self-comparison and your own journey and all of that stuff. But it's really remarkable to hear how much things have zigged and zagged for you to get you.
Five careers.
Right? Like five careers. I mean, it's truly remarkable. It's so inspiring. And then, you know, the fact that you've been able to transition all of this and still mentor and you're still teaching, like there's so much that you're still doing and giving back while you already, you stepped into this director role. I'm curious though, like, what would you say, now that you've had enough experience in this particular area, is the biggest or the most important part of like the director-producer relationship that you've experienced, especially from the director's perspective? Like, what are the things that you wish producers knew about working with their directors? Maybe some of the misconceptions, like any of those nuggets, I think would be really great.
Yeah, I think, you know, as a director, we have to come in with ideas and also confidence. And sometimes that takes a supportive community, right? Because we're sometimes doing things we've never done before. And I think there's an expectation because of some of the kinds of directors that have come before us. And I remember on one show, it was like the first 5 minutes of prep, and there was like some VFX heavy something. So, and I didn't know, what do we have on this show? What are the tools? Can I get a motion control camera? Can I, like, I didn't know how to solve the problem yet. And I often replay in my head, like, I wish I had answered this differently. Cause I was like, well, first 5 minutes of prep, I promise I'll let you know as soon as I know, is something I said. And I knew that white dude judged me in that moment, and I did not go back to that show. And I think it was because of that first 5 minutes of prep. I should have been like, well, do we have a motion control camera? And could we do this? And what about that? Da, da, da. But I am very technical, but I don't have to walk around flexing all of my technical knowledge. Sometimes I just want to, like, I want at least the first half an hour to like know the show, the vibe, the team. And then I'll start saying, okay, like, can we do this? And can we spend money on this? And I think sometimes, especially as a guest director, I think it would be helpful to create the conditions to help other people be great. So the shows that do that, that give you a lookbook of the showrunner's favorite shots or something that the pilot director and the DP put together. Or when the showrunner or producer say, here's our favorite scene, or this is what we're going for, or here's the things, or just some sort of creative welcome that often is conducive of like, I can come in and be confident and great because I know what you all like. Like, right. You have preliminary conversations, but you've really had like a 45-minute interview, and then you get hired, and then you're just thrown in, and they're like, how will you shoot this really complex thing that you've never done? And so some producers are like, they just sort of throw you in and expect, you know, frankly, I think a lot of male television directors before this moment, a lot of men just come in and they just, blah, 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 this is what we're doing. And not all of us, blah, 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 blah. I'm not a marching orders kind of person. I'm a creative collaborator. I'm a visionary. I'm like, okay, what I want is this, because I see my role as keeper of the story. So how do I preserve that heartbeat, that story, that soul? And then I want to explore the creative options. So like, tell me the best version. Like, what gear do we have? How much can we spend on the sequence? Like, what can we do? And creative collaboration looks different with different kinds of directors. And I think in television, there's like, Queen Sugar was a show that created conditions for first-time television directors to be great. Domaine Davis was the producing director on my season.
Yes.
He called me on the phone and said, you know, what are you thinking about? What questions do you have? And then she sent me a lookbook of these are Ava's favorite shots. This is the sort of big Queen Sugar white. And I had watched the show. I had fallen in love with the imagery, but actually being given tools and information versus other shows that you jump in and you're there for 2 minutes and they're grilling. Mm-hmm.
And just to back up for the listener, so as I understand it, and fill in the blanks where I'm, you know, missing things here, but when you are hired to create a pilot as part of that creative team, there's a blank template in which you're creating from. And once you set the look of the show as a DP, once you set the tone of however shots are going to be from a directorial perspective and a producerial one, then everyone who's hired from there on out to guest direct each episode is sort of hired to take that blueprint, put their own spin on it, but not too crazy because it's still got to live within the world of the show. Is that correct?
That is correct.
But it sounds like you're saying that most of the people who are responsible for that front end setting the blueprint then are not going and saying, wow, let me now create this guide to help anyone who's stepping into this have all the information they need so that this is consistent and you have like, here's the parameters. As long as it's within this, then you can play within this sandbox, right? And it's shocking to hear that this isn't a normal practice, because obviously this would lead to much more coherent like creation and also give the directors who are stepping in the time to actually think about creative solutions to things instead of taking the job and then having to also like low-key figure out what is this while doing the job with the finite amount of time. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's just crazy. Cause I've come up mostly on the feature side of things and it's obviously very different. So it's just wild to me that, again, it's such a risk-averse industry, but then when you have all the money and all the risk, there is not as much care to make sure that everyone is set up to mitigate that risk, not go over budget because they know exactly what they're stepping into.
And it gets into the machine and it's just going, and then you're just part of that machine, and here's this and here's what it is, and here, you know.
But it doesn't take that much time on the front end. Correct me if I'm wrong. You've directed pilots.
I don't think it does. So, you know, every show goes through like the pilot director and the DP put together mood boards and lookbooks, and every department head has what wardrobe will look like, what the sets look like, what the sort of color palette is for that pilot. And then they do what's called a show and tell to the network and studio folks. So those materials exist. There are PDFs. There are PowerPoints. My favorite shows, my favorite producing directors have sent that material, have been like, here's our show and tell book. And then I'm like, oh, this is what it looks like. This is what it feels like. On a season one show, the pilot director who became the producing director invited me to all the dailies so I could watch what he was shooting. So I not only had the scripts for the whole season and their presentation and some visual references, but I also had, like, I could see what was developing on set and those early cuts and those things. I think that creative collaboration is really inspiring and sort of welcomes you in. So I feel like when producers can facilitate that creative community, creative sharing, that collaboration, then I think the shows are better for it. But most shows don't do that. You just show up, you get your script. You're supposed to have it for the first day of prep. Sometimes you don't. Most of my shows I do. And that's really the blueprint. And then whatever episodes existed, if you saw them. So then I do the lifting of finding who are the creatives on the team who want to share, so that I become friendly with folks. And the production designer is always someone who has a lot of information and insight because they've been in all of those conversations, and certainly the DP. So you forge this great relationship. And, you know, the producers are just sort of moving the show along. And in television, it's the showrunner who's the, you know, head producer and head writer, but they're invested in moving the story along. They're not necessarily like, they're like, oh, you figure out the camera thing, which of course I will figure out the camera thing. But in the first 5 minutes of prep, I don't know what do we carry in on the show? What is an extra rent?
Right.
What is the thing? So like, I always try to be active in emailing and introducing myself. And then after I meet the DP, then say, what's the camera? What's the lens package? What's the gear? What do we keep? Does this show use Steadicam or do we do this or do they ever
is
have?
Is there at any point in this process, do you sit down with the line producer or the UPM and they kind of sit you through and go, okay, you're coming in episode 5 of 12. Like, this is where we're at. Typically, we're spending at, like, some kind of guidance on the spend. So you would literally go in having no idea if you're getting $1 million an episode or $100 million.
So $3 million or an $8 million.
Why do you think that is?
I think people just are like holders of information. I think it's like this operating from a need to know basis. Like, do you need to know this? No, but it would be helpful. And I think honestly, the new DGA guidelines where you'll find out if your episode's above 6 million or not, because then you get, if you're in an SVOD episode, you'll get additional creative rights in post-production. And right. I was like, yeah, I wonder how many shows I would have gone over this $6 million mark. And I said to the DGA, how do I know? And they're like, well, you can call and ask us, or when you book this, like, I have an episode coming in May, but the guidelines don't start till July. So it's an SVOD show. I don't know where it would fall, if it's under 6 million for the episode or over 6 million. And I don't have the script, so I have no idea. So it's a different thing.
It's different. And I understand there's like the dichotomy, having come up as a line producer, there's always a lot of protection. You don't want to just share budgets far and wide, because then people start to try to make decisions for you of how you should be spending that money. And you're one department, one person, you don't know all of the things that that person is juggling. So I understand that perspective, especially on a TV show where you're amortizing costs and there's so many moving parts, right? You're block shooting, like, it's insane, like, the way it moves. But I it's bizarre to me that there wouldn't even be a generalized sense of parameters to which, again, you're stepping into a sandbox knowing, so that you're not thinking of ideas within a really constrained timeline that are outside the scope of what a show can afford.
So once in a while, a line producer will give you a couple things. Like, this show typically does this many days out on location, this many days in. And or the AD will have put a preliminary schedule together before you even meet with them. And then they're figuring out, oh, are you going to need more time for this? Or, you know, where are we within the boundaries of the hours that we have? Where are we going to figure out and prioritize and put most of our time and energy and resources? What's the crane day? What's the this? So I typically ask the AD, like, do we have this? Do we have that? And like I said, I'll email the DP and say, what's in our package? Because I'm a person who uses apps, like a viewfinder app. And so I'm already looking, like, if we're shooting in this tiny dressing room, how wide can we make it feel? And I'll have those creative conversations. And so my interaction with line producers sometimes, more often, are, hey, Rachel, step into my office. And then we're in front of the calendar. And then they're like, can you stay until the day before Thanksgiving? And I'm like, I'm supposed to like fly out. I literally have 2 days for Thanksgiving and then I start my next show. And they're like, could you? And I'm like, no, like, I can stay till this date. That's really the conversations that you have, are usually about schedule, because they are juggling so many things. And I don't need all the information. I think from the creative producer side, any information that can be shared with a guest director that helps the vision, building the world, playing in that playground, is incredibly helpful. So when you have shows like Queen Sugar that gave you visual guidelines that explained, well, you're only going to have one crane day, so any of the scenes you need, make sure they're all there so the crane can do those things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But other shows, you're sort of asking. And so you're just asking all of these folks rather than a sort of welcome to the creative world of a show.
Right. You're just like combing for the information instead of just being given it on the front end. Like you said, like having to kind of piece it together in real time while you're also stepping in to direct. It's a lot. I'm fascinating. I have to talk to more TV producers to understand the rationale behind some of this way of working, because certainly it's just been like this for a long time. I'm sure people just stepped in and it's just how it's always been done. But I think in the spirit of creating a more collaborative industry, a more compassionate industry where we can truly understand what people are up against, you know, because I think like if you knew the constraint, especially if you're coming in at the end and they're like, we usually have 5 million, girl, we got 3. So let's think through some really creative ways to get you everything you need, but here's what we're up against, you know? Like having, you know, it doesn't have to be like, let me show you the budget, but just having those kind of real, real conversations with creatives, to me, it's like what's missing, because oftentimes there is this divide between the creative ideas and the execution and what it costs to do those things. And so the more that we can inform and empower creatives, I think the more they're coming in and going, okay, I'm not going to come in butthurt that I don't get 18 crane days. I know I get the one. How else can I find really creative? How can I already start thinking about creative solves for this team, for this production? Call me crazy. I don't know.
I remember once I said something about windows and then the line producer was like, no window treatments, they're very expensive. And I was like, cool, we don't need to. I was like, this can work.
Just
let me know what we need to do and I'll work with those constraints. Like, it doesn't have to be a big thing. I'm not here to fight and spend the money. I'm here to tell the story and preserve the story and honor the story. And so I think when creative and budget bump against each other and there's not real clear lines of communication, we're on one show and it's a big budget show with a lot of VFX. The number two had written the episode and then brought the budget and said, Rachel, let's talk through this. And I said, how much do we need to cut? And it was a lot of money. But then I was able to really think about, okay, well, what do we really need? And if instead of seeing down this whole way where we need to paint in the skyline, if I just catch them coming in and we see less of down the street, that's going to save thousands and thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't change the story. Like, we still will feel like we're in a big city and we'll have more taxi cabs cross, which we already have the cabs. It's cheap. So like I can creative decisions, but of course I'm going to dream big because that's my role, is to like envision this world, the biggest possible. But then it's more important to have the details and things and spend the money on this than seeing more skyline or something down the street, which probably for a time we would cut anyway, because you know, if no one's talking on that move, usually you end up losing
pieces
because they don't cut as many words when you're in the television space. So I think to honor creativity, that's really what I want producers to understand, is what are the ways, yes, you can do all your job and make the budget work, but is there any little thing that you can do that honors and supports the creative vision of the show? And so when you walk in a production office and there's beautiful images all over the walls and you see what the art department has put together, and on one season one show, that lookbook that the pilot director and the DP had done together was printed in beautiful images hung in the wall. Because you walk into the production office and your director office and it's just these blank, drab, white walls. Well, they had someone on the team print full color pictures. And I walked in and I sat at the desk and I was able to look at the quality of light and the color palette and the way they want to frame big close-ups with a 40 millimeter lens instead of a 50, and what they wanted to do with this sort of sodium lighting and the sort of glowing atmospheric light. And I was able to sit and make creative decisions under this wall of images that really were inspiring. Super simple. It's not a big thing. It's like, how can even that space, the shows that you walk into and there's thoughtful welcomes, right?
Like
headshots of all the cast. And I'm a scriptation iPad lady. So just send me all the things. I want the floor plans. I want the headshots. I want whatever, you know, pictures. What is the world of the show? Like, help me help you is really what I want.
And so would you say, is that what, in your opinion, makes an exceptional producer? Have you felt like you've worked with exceptional producers? If you had to define what would make an exceptional producer to you?
An exceptional producer is creating the conditions for that creative team to achieve that vision. And so most directly, I work with producing directors. So the good news is they are directors and producers, someone like a Demaine Davis.
Yes, who's been on the show and is lovely.
She's thinking mindfully about producing and all the things, and is this achievable and will that location work? But she also understands what it takes for a director to come in and do her job. And so I think producing directors can be fantastic when they are the bridge between the financial and the producers and the pressure and the studio and the things and the notes with the creativity and the vision and the on-the-ground decision-making. And I think that role of producing director in television can be someone who really transforms and connects what I'm going to say, the top with the ground. I don't want to say top and bottom is weird, but even as a director, you're in this sort of on the ground hierarchy. You're not in those rooms making decisions. And so the producing directors are those who are giving me lookbooks, giving me insight into how things work and what resources we have and what are the limitations and what are some of the challenges, and facilitating the business and the practice, the creative and the constraints. Those are my favorite producers or producing directors who can do that.
What are some misconceptions you think people have when they think about episodic directors, TV directors, that you wish people knew in the industry, but maybe outside of it as well? Just misconceptions that people may have about what it takes to do that job or the realities of that job.
You know, I hear sometimes students say, well, you know, like in TV, you don't really have creative vision and you're just there and you're like a directing robot. That is not true. I get to do amazing things and really cool things. And I have all the big toys and really professional crews. But yes, it has to look and feel like the world of the show. Only when I'm directing a pilot am I inventing what that world looks like and those rules. But it is not limiting in creativity. It's to me really creatively challenging. And like, how do you make this scene dynamic, or how do you go within a certain traditional form of coverage, but still make it compelling, or like add your little spice or sauce? My own pet peeve is directors who are not heavy in prep and or deciding their shots. There's some directors who are like, oh, I just let the DP do the camera stuff. And that irks me. It's not so much of an outsider's perspective, but sort of this ugly secret of, and this idea that like women aren't good with camera or the technical. And so then, you know, the DP does these things, and I'm creative collaborator through the whole process. Yeah. So TV is challenging in the time constraints. And so I block really quickly, and I know how to adjust and block using lines so that I can efficiently get through a scene, especially if we're losing the light or there's lightning or there's rain or there's something. And so it's a great space to play in creative voice and vision. It's a great space to work as a collaborative team member with showrunner and writers and actors and all of, you know, the whole team. But it also is this like incredibly challenging timeline and pacing. And it's for some people like directing on steroids when I show like what I achieve in a day and how many setups and how many shots and how many versions of all, especially in comedy. It's like, can we do it this way? Can we do it this way? There's like six, this one line. And, you know, sometimes indie filmmakers that I mentor or film students are like, what? How much did you do or shoot? Or
in one day. Yeah, yeah.
I love it. I think it's exciting. TV is fun. It is creative. It is fast paced. And it's for really good directors who can flex skills in, you know, creativity and communication and all the directorial craft stuff, from blocking to working with actors to like shots and setups, coverage and balancing creative and technical. I love it. I think TV is really an incredible space.
And you have to be really decisive, I think, again, as someone who's come up in the feature side. You know, you're dealing with filmmakers. It's usually a singular vision, even though there is a collaboration and everyone. The best filmmakers, of course, have a very strong point of view, but a lot of malleability to listen to other perspectives and ways of doing things. But, you know, this idea of like, well, I'll just kind of feel it out, or no movie I've ever shot, we were doing like three pages a day where it's just like a cush kind of, you know, you're doing like an insane amount of pages anyway, because that's the indie space. But, you know, I think this idea of prep especially is super important. And I'm curious, like, for people who are listening who maybe haven't had as much exposure to the technical side of things and maybe do get a little nervous when it comes to understanding cameras and shots. Like, I've worked with a lot of women directors who, you know, privately express this to me. They're like, oh God, that's like one area where I'm terrified. Like, I don't know the difference. Like, you know, aside from when they're in a prep phase with their DP to really take interest, like ahead of that, what can they be doing on their own time to really start to feel more confident about learning these tools and being excited about it versus maybe scared of it, you know, because it is that also technology and digital space moves so quickly and it's constantly changing. But what's like your nugget of like, okay, here's what you can be doing to really get this down and feel confident about it?
Yeah. So one of the things as directors is the amount of time you spend actually directing on set is much smaller than the amount of time you think about directing on set. You know, most of us are not on set every single day. So what can you do to flex your muscles and to build your skills? Block a scene. Take a script, maybe something you did, or just a script of your favorite show. They're all over the internet. And block that scene. Envision. Put it together. And then if you want to watch how another director did that scene, watch it. Watch for the story and the dialogue and the pacing, and then rewatch it with the sound off. And watch shot by shot and look at your plan. Did you have them enter the door and come this way? Did they stop at the desk? Why? Why not? How did that desk become the obstacle in between these two characters and conflict? Like, you can go back to the film school roots, whether you went to film school or you chose not to go to film school or didn't go for whatever reason. The things that we do in film school is that we practice, we study, we stretch, we grow. And so take a script, design your own little set, do a little floor plan, do a shot list. And honestly, I've been teaching classes. I've been mentoring DGA directors, indie directors, and film students on how to block, how to shot list, I do blocking boot camps, and I'll take a scene that I directed. And then you have, you know, 20 minutes to come up with your rough plan and then share it back and practice. There's other directors who will bring me their hardest scene from their script. And then I'll say, let's break it down. So I secretly coach showrunners who want to direct. I coach writers who want to direct. And then they bring me and I'll say, okay, great. What's the hardest scene? What scene are you afraid of? Oh, you're afraid of directing this intimate scene. Let's talk about it. Let's prep. What would you say with the intimacy coordinator? What are some of the conversations you'd have with the actors? What's the plan that you would present to the actors about how you're going to film and what you're going to film and what the coverage will look like and how long they can expect to be doing this action over and over and over. And practice. Like, that's the thing is you don't just have to show up on the day and like, this right. is practice. Practice before you get
beforehand,
right? And anyone can do yeah. it. Get a script, start breaking it down, and do it with your best friend who's a director so that the two of you can block the same scene and then share back and then go, well, why would you bring her over here? Why wouldn't you do this? And then you can learn how other directors think. And just
yeah.
when I broke my ankle, that's what I was doing on Zoom, was like teaching and blocking and helping folks because I couldn't be on set. I physically could not wheel my wheelchair out and get on set. Some people can. There's lots of great wheelchair using directors. I just wasn't physically strong enough. I was not well enough. And I still wanted to be directing. So I was teaching.
Yeah.
That watch stuff, read the script, break it down, practice, share back. Those are the things that help stretch your muscles, that help build your communication, that help you block quickly or understand why if your actors land in a certain way and then one turns for a line, that's a whole nother setup versus if they stay looking in that direction and maybe the other one do-si-dos. Like, there's lots of TV shows like a Grey's Anatomy. There's always great blocking in Grey's Anatomy because someone will come in and then someone's talking to them and then this person swaps and they do-si-do and they turn, but they're all facing. So where the cameras are filming them, it hits each actor even when they basically swap marks. So you can study those kinds of tricks by just watching and rewatching yeah. the scene and get good at directing then before it's big money and you're on set and everyone's standing there going, what is it you want to do? Where
yeah.
what do you want? And that pressure, right? You, if you get good at your craft and your artistry, you can have so much confidence in your creativity and your decision making, and you show up on set ready and confident, because it's not if something's going to happen. It's like when and what and how quickly and confidently can you solve those challenges?
Yeah.
And so build your skill set so that when you show up,
I love it.
Ready. Because in addition to being good as a director, it's, I think, as much as how good was the experience for the folks around you.
And that's what gets you hired again. Right.
Like, every did the actors like her? Was she good?
And that's the thing, right? It's like, as women who step in and we get invited back less often statistically, and we have to like ace everything, the more you can show up prepared to handle all of the things that will inevitably happen that'll be thrown at you, the more that you prove yourself, because you do, especially in the beginning, to make people go, I don't know who this is, but I love them. I want them on my next thing. And we talk about that even as a producer, as a creative, as anybody in our industry, like you often get your next job on the job you're on. So how are you showing up and bringing the best version of yourself so that people go, let me look this person up. Like, this is, they're impressed, you know, because it is hard. There's so much on the line, and the people that can just come in and bring it are just like a breath of fresh air. And you want to be that person. So how are you preparing to become that person so that when everyone is looking at you, you are ready to rise to the challenges that will be there inevitably for you? So I think that's like such great advice, whether you are a director, a writer, anybody in the industry who wants to build longevity and sustainability, because we talk a lot about your relationships and how this is a relationship industry. And that's what's going to get you to be the kind of person who is consistently working, even if you have your ups and downs, for the long run, you know? So that's really great. Really great nugget. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the show. This only works when people like you show up and share a bit of your journey with me and the listeners and all of the incredible wisdom that you have to impart. And this is just, again, a little time capsule of your journey, by no means the full scope. But yeah, we're so grateful. And having that director perspective is really informative for me, especially, yeah, just hearing the other side of that coin. It's like my brain is like, I'm going a mile a minute for next time I have a TV producer on to like use your episode as prep for some of these questions and be like, what are your thoughts on this? So thank you so much. I want to move on to the lightning round, which is just five fun questions to take us out. So again, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Good. Okay. So first question of the lightning round. What is a song that teleports you to a happy place?
I've been thinking about leveling up. So I'm going to say today is Ciara, the R&B princess, her song Level Up.
What is the latest piece of art that moved you? It can be a book, a film, a show, etc.
One of my favorite artists is from South Africa. Her name is Faith 47. And she does these really beautiful, often site-specific pieces that are sort of graffiti art meets mural art. And she's really incredible. Faith 47, the number. And Young Pueblo, his book, Clarity and Connection. I've been reading those every day of like some kind of, I've become the lady with the quotes, and I keep putting quotes on social media. So those two things.
Amazing. Okay, fill in the blank. When I'm overworked, blank helps ease the stress.
CBD rub and hot baths.
What is one of the most worthwhile investments you've ever made? And it doesn't have to be financial.
Apple products, my iPhone, my iPad, my MacBook Pro. I do all my work with Apple products, and I couldn't live without it as a director. Couldn't live without that.
Love the endorsement. Let's see if they'll sponsor us. Final question. What is one question actually that you have for the next producer who comes on the podcast? And then I will leave you the nugget that we got from the previous guest.
I would love to ask, what is one thing that a new director can do to help impress you or get on your radar? Like, what is something that someone who is unproven in their career can do to sort of get traction or momentum or get on your radar? Because that's the big question that young filmmakers that I teach and mentor are always like, well, how can I? What can I? And I always say, put it into the work. When you make work that's undeniable, but there are so many really good short films. How do folks level up?
Amazing. The previous guest, whose episode will be released in a couple of weeks, was Judalina Neira. I don't know if you know her, fellow Latina, but her question for the next producer guest was, what do you do to re-inspire yourself when you're feeling uninspired?
So I try to surround myself with good people, good art, good vibes, good food, good music, because inspiration is all around us. And especially during hard times, like what feeds your soul and spirit. And so you don't have to dig for inspiration when it is all around you in what you're watching, what you're reading, what you're listening to, who you're talking to. So surround yourself with things that feed your soul and your spirit, and you won't go hungry.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you so much. This has been such a treat. I could talk to you all day. Maybe we can take this off mic and continue this conversation over copious amounts of whatever your drink of poison is. It would be great to do that. Thank you again. I'm excited for you, cheering from the sidelines with all the things you've got going on, and excited for, you know, our industry to bounce back in a more meaningful way so we can all get back into it. So
absolutely. Yes. Yeah. To Latina-led shows from showrunners,
producers, ojalá,
writers. Like,
yes,
you just got slashed. I've been calling this time like the villain era. You know, they loved all the superhero stuff. But I feel like in that post moment, we're in this villain era of like slash and burn. And what got slashed? What executives got slashed?
So many Latinas I know are like got executives are... And that's obviously a huge problem, because if we don't have the people who look like us and understand our culture, greenlighting our stories, going to bat for our stories, it's like it just becomes such a continued uphill battle. And we have a few soldiers at different parts of the process of that mountain. But it feels like everyone, there's just been a mudslide, you know, and everyone's just like back to the bottom being like, I don't know, like just trying to figure it out. And I think the more important thing is, like you said, that your energy and your spirit, when people are really down, it's hard to like suit up and like get back on the horse and go to battle on behalf of everything that we're fighting for. So, you know,
we are seeds and just plant and water, you know, sunlight and rest and oxygen and things. And then we grow and we sprout and we bloom and we spread out. I love plants, if you haven't noticed.
Thanks so much for tuning in and doing this life thing with me. If you like the show, please don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. I'm at Carolina Gropa. The show's at Angle on Producers. And I'll see you next week. Beijos.